This is a wonderful opportunity. I'm going to be presenting some data, and we call it some exploratory analysis that we're doing at Westchester. One of the hardest things to do with underserved populations, minority populations, immigrant populations, is try to capture utilization. We're going to take you on a journey, our journey, in terms of trying to report some statistics on ambulatory care utilization, specifically for uncontrolled diabetes among Hispanic and non-Hispanic populations. And you'll go through this journey with us. We had to deal with issues of missing data and as well as properly defining things over time. We'll show you where we go from here. At this point, for the last 12 months, I have no relationships to disclose regarding affecting this research. What I'd like to do this morning is go over background, give you a brief overview of the aims of our study, the methods, the results, and then some limitations and recommendations. Let's go over the background. In 2010, when we talk about diabetes, we're really talking about a population that is tremendously large. About 26 million people in the United States are diabetics. And the complications associated with this disease include heart disease, stroke, hypertension, blindness, kidney disease, amputations, and others. So many of us here in the room know someone that has diabetes. The team of researchers working on this project, we both had family members that suffered from diabetes, died from diabetes, so it's something that has a very significant impact in the population. The total cost of diabetes is up around $174 million. If you subset that piece that's only associated with uncontrolled diabetes, there was a recent study that came out in 2004 that estimated that it would be about $2.4 billion just dealing with uncontrolled diabetes hospitalizations. In the same article, when they looked at charges, it was around $2.8 billion. But still, that's a very significant amount of cost and charges associated with this illness. So the aims of the study are to present some preliminary estimates of national ambulatory visits for Hispanic and non-Hispanic patients with uncontrolled diabetes between 1996 to 2005. So it's a 10-year period. To simplify the slides, we collapsed them into five two-year increments. What did we use? We used the 1996 to 2005 data from the National Hospital Ambulatory Medical Care Survey and the National Ambulatory Medical Care Survey collected by the National Center for Health Statistics. We received the CDs, and on the CDs there was a software called Statistical Export and Tabulation System, SETS, and we used that software to generate estimates of visits. That's the key thing about this. I wanted to use this as a learning tool to work with graduate students to enable them to, especially those working in clinics, be able to go into this software, plug in specific ICD codes that they're interested in, meaning specific diseases that they're interested in, and generate national estimates. What we did when we look at ambulatory care in the United States, generally speaking, we have three major categories. One is physician offices, two is the hospital emergency departments, EDs, and hospital outpatient departments. So on the slides, you're going to see PO for physician offices, ED, emergency department, and OPD for outpatient departments, and a T for total that captures all of the above. What are uncontrolled diabetes? We looked at the first diagnosis listed on the this particular visit event, and it had to have an ICD-9-CM code of 250.X2 or X3, where the X2 and the X3 indicate that it's uncontrolled diabetes. And that's the core patients that we pulled in, core visits. We defined Hispanic and non-Hispanic based on the variable that was captured by the database as well. Okay, so let's go through three slides of results. And then I have some word slides afterwards to explain what's going on. First, let's take a look at the total picture. This is now estimated number of ambulatory visits for uncontrolled diabetes in the United States by site by year. And I just have one site to make the slide easy to follow. So on the horizontal axis, we have time split up into 5 2-year groups. On the vertical, on the y-axis, we have visits in thousands. It's a lot of visits that we're talking about. Let's look at the gold bar, which is the total number of visits for uncontrolled diabetes. So if you take the first time period, 96, 97, you're going from about 888,000 visits. And then we have an increase up to the year 2000, 2001, and then back down to 2004, 2005. We try to figure out exactly what happened. A lot of times what may happen in these administrative databases is that you have a change in coding, you have the increase of an expansion in the number of ICD-9 codes associated with uncontrolled diabetes, so you're capturing that condition better as time goes on. But you do have an increase and then a decrease. And it ends up at about 2.2 million visits in 2004-2005. Now, right next to it, I have the physician office column. Can everyone see that column next to the total? Okay. It's in Westchester University purple. I have to put WCU's colors up there somewhere. Okay. So we have in physician office and PO, right next to the first column. So you're looking at 1996-97. So it's about 700,000 physician office visits in the early 96-97, going all the way up to about 1.8 million in 2004-2005. I just want to highlight, if you see the purple column next to the gold, yellow column, there's just a little space left, and that's where outpatient hospitalization and emergency department use fits. So the main thing of this slide, one of the important things, is that outpatient utilization is really nested in physicians' offices in this country. This slide captures the other three sites. So we saw that uncontrolled diabetes increased from about 890,000 to 2.2 million, but the specific site of treatment increased that differently. So physician offices really captured the bulk of the utilization from 700,000 to 1.8 million. Outpatient hospital visits increased from 87,000 to 274,000, and then the emergency department visits went from 100,000 to 123. Now let's see what happens for Hispanic versus non-Hispanic populations, and that's my next slide. So this gives you the estimated number of visits for uncontrolled diabetes in the U.S. by ethnicity. Blue is non-Hispanic, red is Hispanic. So here we're going from, this is now taking into account if the variable ethnicity had missing information, in other words, if a person wasn't sure if a person was Hispanic or not, they have a blank listed in the analysis. I pulled out all those individuals and just kept who said that they were Hispanic ethnicity. So as a result, these are undercounts, possibly. Okay, so on the blue side, we have about 600,000 visits in 1996-97, increasing to 1.6 million visits in 2004 and 2005. In the same time, the Hispanic numbers went from 150,000 to 370,000 visits for uncontrolled diabetes. Now I'm going to pull out two slides looking at first the non-Hispanic and then the Hispanic distribution by site. I'm going to show you that. So this slide captures what happened on the figure, but it just elaborates a little bit more on the site piece to be able to talk about the increase. So overall for the non-Hispanic population, it went from 600,000 to 1.5 million, but the visit sites were parallel to what we saw earlier for the total population. You're going to see a difference for the Hispanic population. For this site, we see that the physician office site increased over two times from 468,000 to 1.2 million. On the outpatient site, that's where you see a significant increase in utilization from about 58,000 to 221,000 visits, about three times. And then what you hope to see in terms of controlling cause, controlling the disease, is the emergency department visits went from 77,000 to 93,000. Not a huge increase during that time, which is, in some ways, good. Now let's take a look at what happened with the Hispanic population. We saw also an increase from 150,000 visits to 369,000 visits in 2004 and 05. But the distribution of site of location was a little bit different. And that's why I'm happy that I'm coming at the end of the discussion panel, because the other speakers have already alluded to this redirection of visits. Take a look at this. So the physician office visits went from 131,000 visits to 300,000 visits. Okay, so you see, again, over a twofold increase. The outpatient department went from 16,000 to 34,000. Again, over a twofold increase. But this was interesting to us to see the emergency department utilization increase over fourfold. So from 5,000 to almost 20,000 visits. And it raises issues that we can talk about during the discussion in terms of, is it due to magnitude of disease or access to healthcare? The last slide, I try to capture this whole notion of percent of uncontrolled diabetes. So this slide, we have the same distribution by time on the bottom. Blue is non-Hispanic, red is Hispanic, and the column now, vertical axis is now percent of visits. So what we're doing is we're taking all of diabetes and then allocating what's the percent of that total diabetes that is uncontrolled. So for the non-Hispanic population, it's at about 2%, 2.1% in the blue column in the 1996-97 year period, and it increases up to 3.9% in the 2004-2005 period. Now, what happened for the Hispanic population during that same time period? They're in red. And there it goes from about 3.4 in 96-97 all the way up to about 5.9 in that time period. Now, the word slide captures the two trends that we just talked about. It looks like in the non-Hispanic population, we did see a slight increase in the percent from 2.4 to almost 4% in that time period. And again, in Hispanics, from 3% to about almost 6%, 5.9% in the 2004-2005 period. This is pretty interesting in terms of some of the data that we were looking at. What are some of the limitations or some of the findings? We have overall that it looks like uncontrolled diabetes affecting the Hispanic and non-Hispanic populations may have increased in terms of those visits over the last 10 years. The percent of uncontrolled diabetes appeared to be increasing over time and also higher among the Hispanic populations that we examined. This preliminary analysis has a lot of limitations, as you can imagine. We have the unit of analysis oftentimes is the visit and not the patient. So that gives us limitations as to what we can do to find out what are the reasons for the differences that we see. We haven't been able to, with the software right now, calculate rates at this level of resolution. Excluding those imputed Hispanic visits may underestimate the actual number of visits. We have definitely mentioned that because it's a limitation of the study. And it's hard to account for some of this imputation because it definitely has varied over time. We recommend using data from 2003 and on. We have a feeling that it's important to improve access to primary health care, especially when we saw the shift in increase at emergency department visits. And I think our next phase is going to be looking at verifying a lot of these estimates with other statistical analysis software like SAS. And that's the next step that we see. That will be joined with updating the analysis of more recent data over time.
Questions? Comments? Thoughts? Yes, sir.
My name is Matt Cadler from the UCLA School of Public Health. I actually have a question about the infectious disease presentation. I think it's really important to call attention to the need for access among immigrants, but I was wondering if you have any recommendations or experience in walking the line between calling attention to it without presenting immigrants as a public health scourge.
Thank thanks for raising such an important question. It really matches well with what I presented. I think one of the things what we do in public health is that we try to officialize or, you know, make it very official, the interventions that we plan. I think one of the things would be, and I'm doing something for breast cancer awareness in the city where I'm working right now, one of the things could be start at the very grassroots level, not make it a big hullabaloo out of any intervention that you have, and let the community members feel accepted in the community. That will increase their trust in the healthcare system, and they'll be more open to come and get these services. That would be a start, so they're not scared to come and get treatment, and they're registered, you know, they don't feel that they're coming to seek care and they might be deported. This is also an opportunity, this will also provide an opportunity to educate them that not only the disease or the illness or the ailment they're suffering at that moment that they need to pay attention, but there are other things for them, other things also that they can get treatment and be involved in the preventive care. So probably starting in a very non-official at the grassroots level, in a very unofficial and at a level that works well with the community, keeping in mind the language and the cultural barriers would be an excellent thing to start.
Dr. Delgado?
From UCLA, right? Okay. The clinic that I set up was at Mission City Clinic over in San Fernando Valley. And one of the things that we saw, I guess a parallel example was with head lice, and how it exploded in terms of, because people were living in garages, multiple families in garages, multiple families in apartments. The population really is transient and moves a lot, so when you do a health education intervention, my ignorance initially was that, oh, I'd go in and do, you know, an education intervention at the school, at the local apartment house, but the thing is that they moved. So you have to plan to do the intervention again and again and again. So it's not just one shot and it's over with. It really is, like you mentioned, a really important community interaction, but also once a month or at least a couple of times a year, because that one family that was in that one apartment may be, you know, substituted by another family 6 months later. So the message needs to really be kept continual. And with breast cancer, with the work that we did with breast and cervical cancer, it also needed to be by women, by nurse practitioners, culturally appropriate, and also linguistically at the level where it works. The third example is grew up in New York City, went to LA. My Spanish, I thought was Spanish, but sometimes you need to make sure that the terminology that you use is appropriate to the culture that you're working with. So what may have been cool for, you know, Puerto Rican, Cuban, Spanish on the East Coast, you know, I really had to modify sometimes for Guatemala, Mexico, and the West Coast. So that's kind of the third lesson. Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Sanya and Dr. Delgado. Next question, please. Please, ma'am.
I have a question about what you said about health that having to repeat it, but that's pretty standard with all of our health messaging. Over at once and expect our, you know, the general, we may all understand what this health messaging is about, but who we're delivering it to, it has no value necessarily to them immediately. So we always have to be repetitious with our messaging, even if they move or don't move.
I think the comment was that universally when we do health education, please correct me, that repetition is necessary, and I think that has been exemplified here, right? Questions? Other questions? Thank you for that excellent comment. The comment was that we got to have people from the same culture who speak the language, and they should be nurtured, they should be encouraged, they should be supported to get into health professions so that they can be the providers who are culturally sensitive and they are adept to the language to communicate with the people who are coming from special language groups who may not be speaking English as the primary language. Thank you for that comment. Other questions? Thank you for the question. The question is, how do you create cultural competency among, the question was towards physicians, but I think it is true for any healthcare provider, it is true for any coach, it is true for any educator, virtually every profession. How do you create that cultural competency among the providers? That capture?
I'll try to answer the question to the best of my ability. I could give you an analogy from the country that I come from. I come from India, and even if you're in that country, that is not if you work in one state or province that you can easily communicate or work with other people. So being raised in India, we were very sensitized to work with different culture, different religious groups. I think that kind of thing that you try to adapt, try to understand where they're coming from, and not impose our culture on them immediately. For example, when we work with, I'm not from US, I'm from India, but when I work with people who are from US, there are two things that we have to balance. One is understand their culture, where they are coming from. And when we are trying to tell them what is the healthcare system or what's best for them based on the premises they are in right now, we bring them to a level that they understand something is not imposed on them, but something they have a choice, that they can choose to use something that's available in US and adapt it to the way their culture allows them. And that what builds the trust and it, you know, works well with the people that you're working with. Another example, I'll repeat the work that I'm doing for breast cancer in Macon. I work with the minorities, mainly the African American people, to raise awareness. Now, telling them that you already have a higher risk and you are, you know, at every bad statistics when it comes to breast cancer doesn't help them. But probably raising awareness that it's an illness that's affecting younger women, what are the resources available, how they can overcome the barriers, how they can improve the perceived risk, that brings them to a level where they are placed at a mental level that they can, you know, gain some from the resources available and at the same time overcome the cultural barriers. I don't know if that answers your question or not. I'm not a physician. I think if Dr. Shankaran is a physician, I would let him. I think physicians would be able to, I'm an educator, so probably physicians will be better able to answer this.
The first part of the question, something that what could physicians do to become more culturally competent? And the other part of it was, I'm thinking of the answer to the question. I forgot the first part of your question. I was thinking of a solution, and that was, at the clinic that we established in California, we had providers that were initially of different race ethnicities than the population. And one immediately enormous piece was health education. And so we immediately hired health education staff that was bilingual and bicultural. We hired an immigration worker to help us case manage people who had a tremendous relationship with the community. They were trusted, they were respected by the community. So building in a health education component with the clinical visit released some, or helped to deal with some of the health education pieces that we were confronting with both the breast, for example, with the breast and cervical cancer program. And when we think about becoming more culturally competent, I always initially start at Westchester with being aware of our own culture, our own definitions of how we define health and illness. Then through there, put yourself in the eyes of your patient and then look through their eyes. What is it that this patient is saying with their silence? Silence is important to patients, just as talking. How is it that their society, social upbringing is affecting the way that they define illness, the way that they seek medical care, the way that they seek alternative care? How can you also work with alternative medicine, traditional medicine, alongside with allopathic modern medicine as well? So I hope that this helps answer the question.
I would just add to that there are training programs which are available, cross-cultural healthcare in Seattle, Washington, has got a whole series of educational materials as well as training programs. Then some ethnomedicine on the web is a good place to get some resources. I think irrespective of whether we are provider or not, one reality which we all have to understand is we have seen this world through these pairs of eyes. My pair of eyes is different from everyone else's. And that pair of eyes is actually the cultural filter. Everything which I sense is through that cultural filter, and that introduces a tremendous amount of bias in terms of what I see, what I perceive, what I think is important to be seen, what I think is important to be listened. And that's what Dr. Delgado and Dr. Sani are mentioning, is that we got to understand what our biases are, and at the same time there has to be humility in terms of cultural competency, because there are tens and thousands of cultures, and I don't think one lifetime is enough to learn about all the nuances of different cultures. But at the same time, your question is very pertinent. So the easier way to look at it is that what is the catchment area where this provider is going to be dealing with? What are the three or four or five major cultures where the person is going to interact with from people from those places and then develop the training program? It's not a one-time one, it is ongoing. For a quick one, there are things like culturogram, gives the culture in 2 pages. At least the major FUPA wouldn't be done using those things. But I think it is an ongoing process. But the most important thing is the person, that's us, willing to be trained, willing to learn. And there's a wonderful acronym. American Medical Association has more, I would say, in terms of cultural competency than many other organizations, is learn to listen to the person. Know their explanatory model. What do they think to be the cause of the disease? Agree to what the two people, that is the provider and the person who is the in front of the provider, in terms of how different their explanatory models are, or their explanatory models are similar, and then make some recommendation based on what the cultural characteristics are. For example, if someone has a religious background or cultural background where they cannot eat certain meat or no meat at all, there's no point giving dietetic advice where we say that meat is a high source of protein. It's not going to work. And then finally, the last piece of that mnemonic is N, negotiate. Negotiate agreement, and that's what where Dr. Delgado mentioned, in terms of bringing their practices and the Western practice, which most of us are using, and we try to bring together. If it is harmless practice, let people practice. If it is harmful, tell why it is. And if we don't know as providers what they're all about, accept ignorance, tell them that we'll find out and then get back. I think that's the hardest thing to say, is to say, I do not know. But I think in terms of cultural competency, that's absolutely critical to do so. Yes, ma'am. So first the lady in the back, and then excellent question. The question is, please, ma'am, correct me if I get it wrong. The question is that given that the Healthcare Reform Act, which is going to kick in terms of its full effect in 2014, how are the immigrants particularly, and could include the legal and the illegal immigrants, how are they going to be guaranteed primary healthcare services?
So the question is, trying to provide care to a broad band of individuals. My experience with, for example, community health clinics, and a lot of folks believe that ambulatory care would probably be lying more on that particular safety net function. And some of them are federally qualified health centers, some of them are not. But if I were to shift emergency department visits to physician offices or FQHCs or health centers, I think that would be a smart target in terms of trying to have a situation where folks have a more stable source of care. Funding for that would come from, that's a good question. I know that in the FQHC setting, I was able to cover a lot of costs with basically crossing grants from different sources, plus cost-based reimbursement for the visits. And I thought that model was pretty powerful from an ambulatory care setting, where depending on the scope of work that the particular clinic is providing, because immigrant populations and non-immigrant populations have a different demand on outpatient visits. So I'm thinking that the cost structure of clinics would also vary, depending on where they are in the country and what the scope of work that they're providing. But moving that to the side, let's say you have cost-based reimbursement, I would have that as a source of funding, of a financing of that of outpatient visits. And I think that stabilizes the condition. The other part of it is what to do specifically, legislatively, with that population. I don't have an answer to that right now, honestly. Yeah.
The question is not so much in terms of the provider training, but how do we increase actually the access, and then we bring in the people from people who are marginalized oftentimes, who are vulnerable, how do we bring them into the fold of healthcare as the healthcare tries to become more inclusive in 2014? Everybody want to think? Okay. I think that's a complex issue, and I don't think the answer is going to be present today. The answer is more likely to come after November of 2012. The reason is that right now, anything which is being said, which is going to increase the cost in terms of providing access, we already know that 31 million people out of the 42 million people who do not have access to healthcare are going to be included in the fold of the healthcare through the legislation. We know that. The question is, how do we pay for it? How do we pay for it? And that is where the question, where there is going to be a tremendous debate. There's going to be a lot of posturing, and I don't think there is going to be the same kind of progress which we would expect in this scale. And when you look at the climate right now, we are in a recession. Even if the intent to be more inclusive is very clear, when it comes to the ultimate thing, which is where is the money going to or the resources going to come from, it's going to be a challenge. I don't think you are going to hear a definitive policy viewpoint within the next year or so. Only when the election is over, only when we know who is controlling the Senate and the House and who is going to be the president, then things might move forward. As I mentioned earlier in my presentation, when it came to the individual and the employer mandate, 28 states out of the 50 are wanting a waiver, and that's more than half. The people have taken this to the court to say that this is unconstitutional to require everybody to have health care. So when you have that mood prevailing in the country, I do not think there will be any quick solution, especially at a national level, especially when it has to provide coverage to almost about 3/4 of the population who do not have coverage right now. It is a very bleak view, but I think it is a more realistic view. Yes, ma'am. The question is that is it okay for a healthcare provider to say, I do not know, to an immigrant? I think, let me answer this question and then let my colleagues add to it. I think many immigrant culture, when people come to a physician, the power relationship is already established, which you rightly, I cannot translate that into into this. It is one of the flow of information is one way. That is from the physician to the person who is seeking care. That is very true. But that needs to be changed. That needs to be changed because one of the critical things in terms of the healthcare system over here is to make the person a partner in terms of their care. And if we take that approach, it is necessary at some point in time, irrespective of culture, for the healthcare provider to say, I do not know. Just like a teacher has to say when a question is posed by a student, I do not know, I'll find the answer and give back the answer to you, because that's the honest answer. Otherwise, what we are doing, and there are going to be a lot of situations. Let me give you one example. The internet is a great equalizer. Before I can find information, the person who comes, let's say that person has migraine. I don't practice, but let me give you an example. That person has got migraine. That person is going to have looked up more about migraine than I could have ever looked up in my entire medical curriculum. And that person is going to come and ask me, these are 5 modalities of treatment, what do you think about it? I may know about one modality. I don't know about other 4 modalities, and one answer could be that, oh, those things don't work. But they actually work for somebody. That's why the patient is bringing those forth. So what I should honestly say is, yes, I know about this modality is good or bad, this is, you can do it or use it in addition to the Western system of medicine. But the other 4, I do not know, because that's the honest answer. And say that I will find out about those 4 and I will either call you or I'll let you know during the next visit. And that's the approach which I would say.
I think I agree with Dr. Shankar, especially when it comes to medical care, because there might be certain practices or certain way the treatment is provided. It might not be culturally accepted and the provider might not be sensitive enough to I'll tell you, I used to work at a hospital during my PhD, and it was very difficult for people from the women from the Middle Eastern, you know, the people who migrated from Middle East, and they would, first of all, be very uncomfortable if they had a male doctor, especially if they went for an OBGYN visit. And usually the residents or the medical students are usually allowed to, you know, be there to learn. And those women would not be very comfortable having so many students or, you know, especially male students in the room. Whereas it would be totally normal for an American doctor or a chief to not understand why these women are so uncomfortable having a male doctor or not comfortable having, you know, other students in the room. I think medical care gets even more complicated than what role we educators play. It becomes very sensitive whether they seek the treatment, how likely are they to come back and seek treatment later on as well. Establishing the relationship at the first time and keeping the cultural component in mind, I think it's pretty essential, and I agree with Dr. Shankaran. If there are some things we don't know, we should say that probably I will, you know, figure it out. And some of the times I also feel that people who have been here for a while, they also make up some things that this is not acceptable in my culture. So I think it's also essential for the provider to say, let me figure out and say whether this is a reality or not, or is the patient or the, you know, receiver trying to get away with something. So I think it's pretty essential if we don't know. And again, internet is a great tool. We can figure out Wikipedia and Google, and if that is really a culture, or talk to people from those cultures. Thanks.
So, a question? Yes, please. The question is that when undocumented immigrants come to for healthcare, how do you offer them confidentiality, and how do you convey that confidentiality to them? Does that capture? How do you allay the fear which they may have about them being reported to the authorities, which may lead to deportation?
And I don't think that you have an obligation as a provider. I mean, I'm a health professional, so I'm not a provider. But, you know, what can I reassure my, you know, if I'm recruiting them or if I'm providing services for them, I'd reassure them that, you know, I'm not obligated in any way to report you or, you know, kind of the legal ramifications.
Okay. So the healthcare provider, how does that person allay the fears which an undocumented immigrant might have about deportation when seeking healthcare?
One thing that comes to mind was an experience trying to recruit patients for a breast and cervical cancer program. And all I can think of is basically you're saying exactly, I think, what you said, which is, the focus is on the clinical aspect. We're recruiting and we're offering services, and part of the process is we'll just provide services to everyone that needs that particular service. We're not collecting information about status, and that's not part of our scope of work, that whole issue. The other part of it is that patients vote with their feet. You know, if you provide lousy service in your clinic, you're not going to see patients come back. If patients know that your clinic is a place of safety, meaning that it's a place where they're going to be treated with respect, that that they have a voice in what is done to them. So if they want an OBGYN visit, but they only want certain aspects of it, and I think we know what we're talking about, that they're in control of what is done as well. I think that's the best answer that I can provide is that you offer the services. This is not an issue that we're going to be discussing. It's not really part of the scope of work. And also that it's a place of, you know, like a church in a sense. It's a safe place where you can get help, your children can get help. And that's kind of the best answer I can offer.
I would just add to that it is not always in the purview of the healthcare provider to provide that. Let me give you an example. It depends on the external environment. Recently you heard about what is happening in Alabama. There was a flight of non-documented students from those schools, and they haven't gone back yet. So it is the external reality which is also going to dictate how much the healthcare provider can vouch for the confidentiality. So even if a person vouches that they're going to be safe and confidential, but if there's a fear in the community, that's going to overtake the decision-making as compared to what the healthcare providers can provide. But at the same time, the healthcare provider's responsibility cannot be diminished or shifted to the external factors, even when the external factors are operating.